Leaders for Sedition, a crime the NGO described as, quote, vague and against the principle of legality. Kasai Kedri, Barcelona.
The situation for childcare in the United States was already perhaps the worst in the Western world. Only Ireland spends less on its children. The average annual price is higher for childcare than for university tuition, and the cost is second only to a family's rent or mortgage. That was before Corona hit. This year, childcare costs have soared nationwide a back-breaking 60%, according to the Center for American Progress. But it has doubled or almost tripled in big cities. Plenty of households weren't prepared for any childcare costs at all. But many free public schools have been shuttered for months due to Corona. The huge price increase has caused parents to quit their jobs just to watch their children and produced financial anxiety for even moderately comfortable households.
Staying home shouldn't be an oath of poverty. You know, if you can afford private childcare, great. Let's have public childcare that's decent and affordable and facilitates people and protects families, because we know childcare should be a right.
The federal government's only household relief package this year gave qualified parents just $500 per child. That covers just a few weeks of childcare. It's not just financial. The upending of supervision programs for minors is being called a huge setback in early development and child safety. In cities like Chicago, a minor is 25 times more likely to die from murder than from coronavirus, but closed schools can't provide any structure, and so 2020 has seen a huge increase in juvenile violence and crime.
It's been very stressful on children, and there's been a lot of fallout. I think there's a lot of fallout with a lot of drug therapies being used at younger and younger ages for children. I wonder how that would be if we had better child care and more child care. Young people, depression, suicide, and I wonder again how much of this is a result of lack of affordable child care.
Despite the increased cost for parents, the scientific data, and the negative effect on child learning, many in the U.S. want schools to remain closed until autumn 2021. The average parents can only wonder how they'll be able to foot that bill. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
As thousands of people continue to die each and every day in the EU from COVID-19, a great deal of focus is on the issue of vaccines. The subject has just been debated by EU lawmakers.
Le campagne vaccinali sono
Inoculation campaigns began in the UK, the US, Russia and China. The European Union, what was it doing? It's been behind schedule again, waiting for some sort of green light from the European Medicines Agency. Same thing with managing the pandemic. The EU worked very badly. Nations had to go it alone.
We are told that the European Medicines Agency, which authorizes vaccines on behalf of the 27-nation EU, will give the go-ahead next week for use of the Pfizer-BioNTech jab. The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted that vaccination will start across the EU on December 27th, 28th and 29th. However, there is concern that nations are not prepared. Apparently, many EU countries have not yet submitted their vaccination plans to the Commission. EU authorities insist the process cannot be rushed.
Safety of vaccines.
We have been speaking to citizens.
We have to take care of getting this herd immunity through the vaccine. So it is key for our Western states to get there now, given that we're almost in the third wave, I think.
I just think that I will not get the vaccines for myself too early. I just want to wait a little bit to see if there are the secondary effects, bad effects on people.
Lawmakers are expressing outrage that the European Commission is resisting calls to share the formula of proven vaccines with developing nations on the basis that it would stifle investment into vaccine research.
I urge the Commission to rethink their position and to show the world that saving lives is more important than saving an outdated model of intellectual property rights. Access to medicine for for all is a human right.
On the economic front, all sides agree that developing a successful vaccine strategy is crucial to preventing the EU from being rendered completely bankrupt. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
House of Kabul is a small but cozy coffee shop in downtown Tehran. As its name suggests, it's owned and operated by Afghan migrants. The cafe hosted reporters along with officials from the Iranian High Council for Human Rights for a friendly gathering to mark the International Migrants Day. It was a chance to both have a cup of tasty Afghan tea called Ghaymaq and talk about the issues facing Afghan refugees in Iran.
I came with my family to Iran 13 years ago and started hospitality management here. I didn't face serious problems during my study in Iran, but now that I want to start a business, I have to go through a complicated process to acquire the needed licenses.
This was also the case for the owner of the House of Kabul Cafe, who moved to Iran 35 years ago and studied fine arts, and then ran this cafe as a family business. His son, Ali Akbar, who works as a barista here, says it was not an easy job to launch this coffee shop.
It took my father several years to get the license to run this cafe. It was because none of our family members have related degrees. But I'm so happy that we finally launched it, and we have many customers who enjoy our Afghan traditional drinks and foods.
More than 3 million Afghans live in Iran. Around 1 million of them are refugees who have fled the ongoing conflict driven by terrorism and the presence of foreign troops in their country. Together with some 3,000 Iraqi refugees, they made Iran the 8th largest refugee hosting country in the world in 2019. The head of Iran's High Council for Human Rights did not ignore the issues migrants face in Iran and said he was here to listen to their concerns.
A significant portion of the Afghan refugees in Iran have entered the country illegally, and this creates some problems, especially with regards to their children's education. But during the past years and following a decree issued by our leader, all Afghan immigrants have access to free education. Today, our Afghan brothers and sisters in Iran are active in a variety of fields, and today I had the chance to speak to some of their elites and listen to their concerns.
Based on the United Nations 2019 estimates, there are around 272 million migrants in the world. That's 3.5% of the global population. Each year on December 18th, the International Migrants Day is marked to highlight the contributions made by the migrant communities and to address the challenges they face. This year, the occasion focuses on the issue of social cohesion as one of the major concerns of each migrant. Afghan migrants here say dignity and respect are the main things each migrant needs to integrate into a new society. This gains even more significance when they try to restart their lives in a place other than their home country, where they seek to build new lives away from conflict and disaster. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
On the issue of flood and earthquake incidents and other such natural calamities, the role of the armed forces is clear. In the flood that occurred in early 1398 in the Iranian calendar, and in the earthquake that took place before that, they have really played a big role. Therefore, our armed forces are really honorable, noble, and valuable. Everyone can feel this. My dear ones, defensive power is an element of national power. If we consider at least three main elements for our national power, one of them is economic strength and stability, which is very important. Another is cultural capability and solidarity, which is fundamental. And the last is defensive power. Defensive power is vital to every country and every nation. If nations are deprived of this defensive power, then those who are after transgressing and taking advantage of nations, and who wish to interfere in their affairs and plunder their resources, today you can clearly see examples of these countries, the U.S. and other such countries, will not leave them alone.
Your light and love, policy, nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
If defensive power is absent in a country, others will not leave them alone and they will attack all their assets. Today, you're a witness to the cases of stark transgression against countries. The bases of power in the Islamic Republic are founded on reasonable bases. We do not pursue power on the basis of feelings, emotions, illusions, and the like. The bases of national power are founded on rational calculations, in other words, on correct and reasonable calculations. The size of defensive power, the width and the length of the armed forces, and the way responsibilities are divided in the armed forces, and the selection of all defensive weapons are based on correct and reasonable calculations. They are based on logic.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهش مند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
God debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The New York Police Department has been found guilty of using aggressive disorder control methods and adding to tension during massive protests. The demonstrations broke out after the killing of a black man, George Floyd, in Minneapolis. While the Department of Investigation has found systemic problems in planning and response by the NYPD. Now, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio was also criticized for his response during the spring protest. So what does it all mean, and will it bring about a change? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate. We're going to start it all off crossing over to Washington, D.C., and let's talk to correspondent Colin Campbell. Colin, thanks so much for being with us. Well, Colin, break it down for us. Exactly what does it mean?
Well, it looks like what happened here is that the mayor, Bill de Blasio, commissioned a report asking for how police responded to the protests brought upon by the death of George Floyd, the man who was killed in Minneapolis after a white police officer kneeled on his neck for more than 8 minutes, leading to his death. And then, of course, we saw the protests happening across the country as many people identified and saw that there were disparities in policing in white and black communities. Now, in New York, where we had these protests, the investigation showed that police used excessive force in the way that they tear gassed people, in the way that they arrested people, in the way that they responded to these protesters, at some points driving police cars into the crowd. And if we remember, in Charlottesville, Virginia, when there were protests there, that is how one woman died. Ms. Byer died by a white supremacist driving his car into the crowd, killing someone. So the implications there are very great, that police could have killed people as they were trying to, quote unquote, do their jobs. And I think what this shows is that there is a serious issue when it comes to policing protests, policing communities of color. This is a long-standing issue, not something that has been an issue or a problem in the past decade or 2 decades or 3 decades. It's been more hundreds of years since the inception of the United States of America. And what we're showing is that even in the 21st century, there are still problems with this that need to be resolved.
All right, thanks so much for that update. That's Colin Campbell out of Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome our next guest to the program. Out of Philadelphia, social justice activist Yanni Narago. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, what do you make of this investigation overall?
You know, it's interesting, and I appreciate the comments of my colleague who was speaking before me, because this has been an ongoing issue. And one of the things that people don't look at often is the history of police. And there are a few histories. There's a history that recognizes that before there was a police patrol, there was a patrol of individuals who were a slave catching patrol, and the connection between those is easily discerned, even especially if you just look at the badges. The sheriff's badge, which is a star badge in the U.S., the U.S. sheriff, is the same badge. It looks the same as the badge that slave patrol individuals used to wear, and so. In both of those instances, the purpose of the police was to protect property. At that time, people were considered the property of those who were wealthy. And this entire police district in the U.S. is really geared to protect the property of the wealthy, whether it's people property and their ability to exploit and use people and exploit people's labor, or it's actual, like, physical property, which is demonstrated when you look at the example of Breonna Taylor, when there was no indictment for her murder, but there was indictment for the bullets that missed her body and hit the property around her. One of the things that they talked about in this instance with New York, and they've been talking about this in a lot of instances across the country recently, is this need for reform. And there are a lot of these people who are leaders who are saying, we've got to do better, we've got to do some sort of reform. And I think the reason that you're beginning to hear this, what's the new narrative that's coming out, there was a recent murder in Philadelphia of a young man, Walter Wallace, who was having a mental health episode and needed support. and was murdered. And what the narrative was of the police at that time was that those individual officers were not trained properly for that situation. And that's the same thing that they're saying now with the investigation, that these officers were not trained.
Okay, stay with me, Yana. We're going to continue this discussion, but let me get my next guest in on this. I'd like to welcome out of Newark, co-editor of Anticonquista, Nicholas Ayala. Thank you so much for being with us. You heard our guest there in Philly and basically saying that perhaps the narrative is changing. Now they're talking about as far as the techniques that have been used and why it's being used. Your take on this? I mean, we have this investigation out of New York talking about and criticizing some of the techniques that were used. It's not the first time that we've had investigations that have actually found some type of abuse by police. Is it going to make a difference this time around? Do you think that changes would be implemented?
Well, one thing that's interesting about the report that came out of New York is, like the previous guest was saying for me, a lot of it comes down to they put the blame on a lack of training, that the officers were ill-prepared to deal with such huge crowds. But in New York, we saw one of the things we saw in the summer was police officers running over people with cars. I'm sorry, but that doesn't come down to a lack of training. That comes down to what kind of person you are and morality. And I think that these reforms that are being pushed by the New York Police Department and the mayor are really just more excuses to try to distract from the real evils that exist within the New York Police Department and really the whole U.S. Police Department. And, you know, these reforms, again, they're not going to, like you said, we've seen them try to push reforms over and over again. When Obama was president, we saw that after the death of Trayvon Martin, there were many pushes for reforms, and there were reforms. They added body cameras onto police officers, and yet 4 years later, we're still having this problem. So I don't think these reforms are really going to achieve much of anything, and they really distract from the bigger issue at hand.
The bigger issue at hand. Well, let me turn to Philly. What do you think the bigger issue at hand is, Yana?
One of the things, the point that I wanted to make, which was started to be made also by the person who just spoke right before me, is that there's a move and a push right now to abolish the police and to create new systems that are actually equitable and just in the United States, where people and communities will actually be able to be protected and safe. And I think that this narrative around reforming the police is an actual effort to push back against the real need to remove this unjust force from our communities and replace this force with something that is built actually with care and protection for all in its core, because that's not how these police are. So the police come and they come with weapons. There was recently a video of a woman who was whose apartment was battered into, and she was naked, and they handcuffed her. Nine male police officers walked around with her standing completely naked while they moved around her apartment, which was not even the apartment they were supposed to be going into. The police don't have concern for these communities. Many of the people are not even from our communities. But even when those kinds of adjustments are made, it doesn't transform anything, because at the core of the system, it is an unjust system, it is a violent system, it is an occupying force in communities, predominantly Black communities, communities of color, and poor communities, and that's not going to change. What needs to change is the existence of these forces in our communities.
Right, so let me just jump in here, what you just said, because you're saying basically occupying forces. So if there are any kind of changes, how far would these changes go, and could it get to the crux of the problem if, according to what you're saying, these are occupying forces? So tell me exactly what you're saying here.
So when you have outside individuals, they are not, for the most part, people do not police their own communities. People are policing other communities. So they are not desired in many of these communities, and they come in with weapons, and they impose their force and whatever it is that they feel, because they have the authority of being police officers, because we have systems that will believe police officers no matter what they say, and often even when there's evidence against them that is on video, there's no kind of relief against what it is they might do in our communities. and therefore they are a military might. We have police officers. We have police districts with tanks that show up in our communities. They have weapons that are weapons of war that they use in our local police departments against our communities. That is a warlike force, and they are therefore an occupying force in our communities. They need to be eliminated completely and replaced with something that's good.
Well, what about that, Nicholas? You heard Yane basically talk about the occupying force and saying they bring in weapons of war. I mean, if we recall Ferguson and the situation Mike Brown in that small town, we saw tanks on the street. And yet we know that there's a difference of how the police usually react in mostly minority or mostly black areas, as opposed to, for example, if it was a white affluent area, and how they would respond. So with that being said, and basically that this is systemic racism, how can it be changed, policing in the United States?
Well, I think the reform movement is one step, is one, you know, one path towards the right direction, but, you know, you need something more concrete. You need something that goes a little bit further. The Abolish the Police movement is a very serious movement and a very serious consideration that we need to be looking at, because what that does is it really tackles the more, and it looks at the systemic issue of racism that runs rampant within the police community. But not just racism, it also comes down to classism, because like we said, or like you just said, the police, they're there to protect private property. They're there to protect, you know, white, affluent neighborhoods. And we saw the difference when they were protesters out at the same time with the BLM protesters. They were anti-lockdown protests in May and April. Those protesters who had weapons were treated far better by the police than any of the Black Lives Matter protesters. So the issue really comes down to is the system, the society that the United States has set up. How do you really fix that is by attacking those core beliefs, those core stereotypes and biases that these people come into the force having, right? And in order to do that, again, you need to tackle the issue of systemic racism. That gets down to abolishing the police, because the police are, like the previous speaker said, they are an occupying force. You know, we saw in the last few years, more people in the United States have been killed by the police than U.S. soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan. I would describe that as a war, and that's a war against our own people that's going on right now in this country. And the only way you stop a war is by attacking those soldiers, or by stopping those soldiers who are engaged in that war. In this case, it's the police. So the only way we tackle this issue is by getting rid of them and wholly recreating the system, which is an institution, which is the police institution. It needs to be based more so on rehabilitation rather than punishment. It needs to be based on understanding of the community's needs, particularly poor communities and black and brown communities, because right now, again, as the previous speaker said, we have police forces who are not from these communities going in to try to protect and serve them, but doing the exact opposite. And that's because they don't understand, they don't connect to the community like people who are from there actually would.
Well, Yane, if you've both spoke about abolishing the police and that this movement is growing, tell me about that. What exactly does that mean? Now, Nicholas just pointed out that it means concentrating more on rehabilitation, but how would that work? There are some critics that say that, as a matter of fact, if you abolish the police, it's actually going to be the minority community then that will suffer, because the more affluent communities will have their private guards and protecting them, and it would be basically the poor communities on their own. How would you respond to that?
Well, the thing is that the police serve those same affluent communities. They don't serve our communities. They don't prevent crime. They show up after crime is committed. And they often show up when there's no crime actually being committed, and they commit harm. And so the police does not protect poor and minority communities. The police are a tool of capitalism, and they use racism and they use classism in order to protect the capitalist interest. But really, it's not even that it's a racism that is driving the issue. It's because racism is its use. It's the communities that actually serve the best, the capitalist interest the most. And in this moment, the minority communities don't serve capitalist interests that much. And so that's the reason why there are individuals who are protected, even if they're not wealthy, because they align with the capitalist interests. And so what we're working to do in this Abolish the Police movement is to actually go back to where we used to be when black people couldn't call the police when we had problems. We had to handle and take care of our problems ourselves. And we did that by having collective communities that took care of each other. So we are building community at the local level. We are building relations at the local level. And we are building responses, and we're building anti-crime realities. Most of the time when there's a lot of crime in these issues, it's because there's a lack of security, because people are hungry, because people are impoverished, because people are housing insecure. So if we address those issues, we can take the budgets that are in the police departments, we can use those budgets in order to address the issues of security in communities, and that will automatically lower the amount of crime that happens in communities, and then be able to build relations so when people have problems, they can turn to their neighbors, they can turn to individuals who know them, who care about them, who know their histories, and those people can help them solve those problems. And we have found through examples, through models, through statistics, that the programs that actually function like that have a much better violence prevention rate than the actual police department's programming. So there's already evidence that this type of a shift is actually beneficial to poor and minority communities.
What about that, Nicholas? How likely will it happen as far as the powers that be when you're living in a capitalist system, and part of capitalism is actually having that lower level want to be used as workers to oppress and basically, I mean, that's a very big part of the capitalist system. So with that being said, then how do you transition to something else when you're still existing in that capitalist system?
Well, I mean, part of the strategy when you're first starting is to build what's called dual power. So you want to build, a power structure in the same place in these communities that rivals those institutions of power from the government. And that's really what we're seeing. I think this is what we're seeing on the ground now to some extent. In some places more so than others. You have mutual aid groups who are coming out. You have groups that are coming out to watch ICE and track ICE and keep immigrant communities safe. You have police watchers, more and more people who are making sure and tracking the police, making sure they're not doing harm in their communities. These are all methods and strategies which begin to build that base of community, which essentially rivals the power of the police. And when you do that, you start no longer needing the police. And again, it should also be important to point out that part of the issue, like we were just talking about, is that economic issue. A lot of the violence, a lot of the problems, the crime that comes from our poor communities stems from the fact that there's poverty, not so much the fact that there's racism. And that poverty is really what we're trying to challenge right now, right? These mutual aid groups, they give out food, they give out clothing. That helps fight the violence more so in our community. That helps fight violence in our communities more so than the police going out there and cracking people's heads with batons or whatever, or shooting people dead, because that's how the police respond. They only know how to respond to violence with violence, whereas here, when we talk about meeting our community needs, we're talking about feeding our community. We're talking about giving people food, providing shelter. That way that they don't have to be on the street. That way they don't have to struggle to survive. That's the first step, and that's how I see it continuing in the future with this movement.
Yane, the future of this movement, we saw these mass protests taking place for months throughout the country this year. Do you see the dynamics of the demonstrations like we saw this year continuing? And your prognosis for the future, do you see, in general, protests continuing, or do you think things will quiet down?
I don't think things will quiet down, but I don't know that it's going to be protest-oriented. Here in Philadelphia, what a lot of the reorganizers have been doing has been shifting from a protest and mobilizing movement to an organizing movement, where we are bringing more and more people together in order to address our own problems and to exact our own solutions. And so I think that there's a change that's not going to be eliminated, right? In the ways that people are thinking, in the ways that we want to engage with each other, and what we believe we have the right to, and what we're willing to fight in order to have for ourselves. But I don't think that protesting, what people are realizing is protesting is one piece, and it's a way that people can come together to express their pain and their rage, and to know that they are not alone in those feelings. But that has not changed us from, you know, Walter Wallace was murdered in October, and those protests were happening all summer long. So, you know, there have been so many people, I've had so many comments who have been firebombed, who have had crosses burned in front of their lawns, and have been murdered, organizers have been murdered in Louisville, and in Indianapolis, and all across the country. People are being arrested by the feds and by different people targeted for their protesting. So we know that protesting alone is not going to do it. We have to build our own power. We have to build our own solutions. And that's where the shift is going, into much larger communal transformation processes. And that's what we'll be seeing as we move into 2021. And that's definitely what's happening in Philadelphia.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us. Out of Philadelphia, social justice activist Jan Nedogo, and out of Newark, co-editor Anticonquista, Nicholas Ayala. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the group right here.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The ICC said that there was a reasonable basis to believe that between 2003 and 2009, British troops murdered at least 7 prisoners and tortured 54 others during the occupation of Iraq. It found there was a reasonable basis to believe that at least 7 captives were raped or sexually abused as detainees in Camp Breadbasket run by British Armed Forces. The stark contrast between ICC's findings and its actions are deeply troubling. It is essentially saying that we know you raped and murdered, but you are free to go because we believe you will police yourself. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Muazzam Beg, writer. This article is published under the heading Failure to Prosecute British War Crimes in Iraq Exposes ICC's Own Failings. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Finds UK war crimes but will not take action. That was the news headlines following the International Criminal Court's publication of its detailed investigation into war crimes committed by British troops during the occupation of Iraq. The ICC's report is based on the findings of a preliminary inquiry to determine both whether there is a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes were committed and to assess whether the UK has itself investigated and sought to prosecute those accused of involvement. The ICC concluded that because the UK was not unwilling to investigate and prosecute its troops for committing war crimes in Iraq, the investigation was being closed. The truth, however, is that the British regime has gone to exceptional lengths to ensure that British troops accused of committing war crimes in Iraq are immune from prosecution. Out of the hundreds of cases pending against British troops, by June this year, only one such case remained open. In March, the British presented the Overseas Operation, that is, Service Personnel and Veterans Bill. The law will place a 5-year limit on criminal prosecutions against troops accused of war crimes and a 6-year limit on civil actions. Any cases outside of these periods will require the Attorney General's consent. There will also be a duty for the government to consider abandoning its commitment to the European Convention on Human Rights, ECHR, ahead of military expeditions overseas. The new law will stop countless claims of war crimes against British troops who served as part of the military occupation of Iraq. The bill had its third reading in the Commons in November and is primed to becoming law in the new year. The aim of the proposed law is to protect British troops from what the government calls vexation litigation. The government often cites the case of Phil Shiner, the British lawyer who successfully exposed the role of British troops in the torture and murder of Musa, an Iraqi man who died in British custody in Basra in 2003. Shiner was struck off by the Solicitors Regulation Authority in 2017 after being found guilty of professional misconduct charges, including paying an Iraqi middleman to fine claimants to make allegations against British troops. Shiner had submitted thousands of claims against the British Army, so this was the opportunity the government, having previously denounced law firms involved in litigation against British troops as ambulance-chasing lawyers, was waiting for. In the same year, the government shut down its own investigation. The Iraq Historic Allegations Team, IHAT, which had been set up to investigate allegations of torture by British troops. None of the IHAT cases led to prosecutions. Despite denying the allegations of war crimes, the government reached out-of-court settlements with at least 326 claimants. It was, however, following on from Shiner's work, that the ICC picked up the baton where the IHAT had dropped it. According to a report, British IHAT detectives said they had seen evidence of war crimes carried out by British troops and alleged that Shiner's case was used to close down their investigation. The ICC said that there was a reasonable basis to believe that between 2003 and 2009, British troops murdered at least 7 prisoners and tortured 54 others. It found there was a reasonable basis to believe that at least 7 captives were raped or sexually abused as detainees in Camp Breadbasket run by British Armed Forces. The stark contrast between ICC's findings and its actions are deeply troubling. It is essentially saying that we know you raped and murdered, but you are free to go, because we believe you will police yourself. This is what one IHAT detective said. The Ministry of Defense had no intention of prosecuting any troop of whatever rank he was unless it was absolutely necessary, and they couldn't wriggle their way out of it. Around 120,000 British troops served in Iraq for 6 years. In light of all that has emerged with U.S. atrocities in Abu Ghraib and Camp Buka, and revelations of the atrocities and cover-ups unearthed by WikiLeaks, it is not inconceivable that British troops committed many war crimes or that the British regime would seek to cover them up. After all, these troops were part of and allied to the most powerful and organized military machine in the world. They were armed, trained, and motivated to fight, capture, interrogate, and kill in the name of Queen and country. Of course, it wasn't just Iraq. The brutality had begun in Afghanistan following the U.S.-led invasion in 2001. An investigation this year found a deliberate policy of executioner-style killings was being carried out by British special forces against unarmed men. Reports also found that British troops planted drugs and guns on the bodies of unarmed Afghans they had killed. Once again, the government was left to investigate itself. Operation Northmoor was set up in 2014, but the investigation was closed down in 2017 after looking at 675 allegations of abuse, but without interviewing key witnesses. The investigation, Royal Military Police, that is RMP, found no evidence of criminal behavior by the armed forces in Afghanistan. In November, the Australian Defence Force, ADF, released findings from a 4-year inquiry that found Australian troops serving in Afghanistan, fueled by bloodlust and competition killing, tortured and executed unarmed Afghan prisoners, and then covered up their crimes by planting guns. In the Australian case, 39 people were killed. Some of them were shot dead. 2 children reportedly had their throats slit. The report includes the chilling account of one special forces operative and how ADF troops idolized British and American troops' atrocities. Whatever we do, though, I can tell you the Brits and the US are far, far worse. I watched our young guys stand by and hero worship what they were doing, salivating at how the US were torturing people. Although at times it has backed ICC prosecutions of individuals, the Trump administration has shown its open hostility to the court by freezing ICC assets and placing prosecutor Fatou Bensouda and others on a travel ban. The ICC is also penalized by the US for investigating the Israeli regime war crimes. Once again, it seems the ICC is quite willing to prosecute Africans, but far less able to prosecute Western nations. It may be because Britain is, by the government's own account, one of the largest contributors to ICC coffers that this prosecution didn't go ahead. Or maybe that the ICC is just a paper tiger. Whatever the case, there is no escaping the connotations of this. The ICC could have set a very powerful and visible precedent in holding Britain to account. It could have given hope and a semblance of justice to those who have neither. Instead, The ICC is a laughing stock, and few will be able to take it seriously again.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.